Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 15. Some people had some questions. Now, one of the things I wanted to mention, and I will be feeding these back into the next set of labs, so you guys manage to escape without doing this part of the lab, but I did actually get... Does anybody remember the lab where you guys did the UDP, or you saw the UDP stuff with Wireshark and TFTP?
Think so.
Yeah, it was one of the four or five labs, and the first bit was looking at web connections and HTTP, and then it went off into... You're looking at the difference in headers between TCP and UDP, and you guys did the TCP one with the sequence numbers and stuff, and then the second part of the lab was UDP and pulling a configuration file off a TFTP server. Is that ringing a bell for anyone?
Yes, I remember now. Yeah.
Ah, well, one of our more industrious students has found a way of getting TFTP running under Windows, and the next group of people through will not have that part of the lab exempt, and you get to do that bit as well. I'm not going to insist on it this time, because I didn't have a solution for it this time, but somebody's given me a nifty URL to a TFTP server for Windows, and has actually shown me how... get it so that you can actually examine those headers.
Is that TFTP 64?
No, it was from some odd company. I'd have to pull David's lab and tell you exactly which company, but he did find one that was a little free TFTP service for Windows from some company, and he was able to capture the UDP traffic and stuff with T-Shark and actually take a look at it.
Cool. Yeah, I've got one that I use to boot my Cisco routers off of running under Windows, and yeah, it's called TFTPD64, I think, is the one that I use. It's a free one.
Okay, well, that'd work. Sorry, what were you going to say, Kevin?
There's one called SolarWinds or something like
that. Yeah, there's a couple of them. In fact, if you go looking at Linksys WRT54G firmware modding sites, you'll find links to piles of them, because that's how you flash the firmware into the Linksys's. Okay, we have two questions, I think, pending. So if we want to deal with those first, and then we'll get into the physical layer.
Matthew, did you have
questions? Yeah, I thought you guys had some questions on labs or something.
I did, but Jason was first.
Oh, was I? Oh, okay. yeah, my question actually was a little bit of clarification on ARP. When I was looking at the traffic, so what seemed to happen is when I pinged something off my network, my router actually sent an ARP broadcast requesting the MAC address from my machine's IP, but it seemed to do that whenever I requested something off network. Is it just that times out periodically, or what's the deal with that?
I'm not sure what the ARP timeouts are on your router, but generally speaking, there's anywhere between 30 and 90 seconds ARP cache. So what often happens is if you ping something off network, you'll see an ARP request for your router if you don't already have it, and then the router will reply, and then in a lot of circumstances, if the router doesn't know who you are, it's going to do an ARP request for your machine to refresh its idea of the cache, so that it knows the hardware address that it's talking to on the local network.
Okay, but doesn't it get that from when I send a packet out? Doesn't it know that address anyway?
No. My understanding of how these things work is it's actually a two-way thing, because there is nothing that says that traffic has to go back the same way it went out, and that's what we call asymmetric routing. You can send traffic out over a dial-up and back over a satellite link. So just because you know the ARP request in one direction doesn't mean that the traffic is going to come back the same way. So if you make that assumption, you limit what you can do with some of your network designs, especially when you're doing things like policy routing.
Oh, okay. Cool.
It's probably also true that the timeouts on a lot of these routers are set particularly low in the 30-second margin because, A, they couldn't be bothered expending too much memory with the ARP cache, and secondly, they figure that one ARP request and one ARP reply is a pretty inexpensive thing to do on 100 megabit Ethernet in 2011.
Yeah, because what's interesting is I never did see my machine send out an ARP broadcast. It always seemed to be there.
Well, the thing you've got to keep in mind is that when you access a MAC address that's already in the ARP cache, it refreshes the cache timer. So every time you talk to your router, which if you've got Skype open or something is about every 5 to 10 seconds, and Dropbox broadcasts itself all over the network every 30 seconds or so, it's going to tickle that timer on the cache pretty regularly, and you're probably not going to see the ARP entry for your router expire very often.
Yeah, because I was doing this inside a Linux VM, I wasn't seeing it. How do you flush the ARP cache on a VM? I know how to do it under Windows, but I don't remember how to do it in Linux.
I can't remember. No, you'd have to do a man up. The only way I've ever seen it was to actually down and up the interface, but obviously if you're SSH'd into the VM and you down the interface, you won't be a very happy camper.
No, I've got Braille TTY running on it, so I've been doing it that way, so I can do virtual console.
You can set up a script to drop it and restart it a couple seconds later.
Yeah, that does work too. If you have a script that does an IF down F0, sleep 5, IF up F0, you can probably, actually you probably should put something like bar bar exit or whatever, so if the command fails the script drops out, but yeah, something like that, and then take it down and bring it back up again, and that should clear the ARP cache. Otherwise I don't think there is one command that will flush the entire ARP cache under Linux. If there is, I'd have to read the ARP man page myself and check, but I don't remember seeing one.
Okay, that's cool. I was just curious.
I think the theory is that Linux machines tend to be routers and connected to a lot more networky things, and it's felt that flushing the entire ARP cache generally isn't necessary, whereas with Windows it might be. Okay, so hopefully that's answered your ARP question. Obviously things are complicated by the fact that you've got switches and stuff in the way. You will see ARP broadcasts for everything, but you won't see the replies unless they're from your machine or you've got them connected through a hub or you've got one of those little switches that allows you to set up a monitoring port. May I recommend the Linksys SL2008? Advertisement ends.
Yeah, I got that going on my Catalyst here. It's pretty cool, the monitoring stuff.
Yeah, you can actually set a port as a monitoring port and shovel all of the traffic down that particular port, and then if you sniff on that port, you will see broadcasts and replies and that sort of stuff. But you do have to be careful with that because it does send all of the traffic down that port, and that can actually cause a hell of a lot of packets to go through that port, and that can upset certain things. Okay. All right. Do we have any other questions? I think we did have another one. Hopefully the ARP one is good for the moment. I will look at the man page later, as I'm sure somebody else will, and we'll see if there is a way of flushing the entire cache, but I don't think so.
Yeah, mine was on the... There was a question on the exam for 7 that made me not sure if I had as good of an understanding as I thought I did, so I thought maybe I should ask about it. They had a basic topology set up, workstation 1 to a switch to router 1, connects to router 2 via serial link or whatever. Then the wrinkle was that I believe router 2 was on a point-to-point link to wireless router 3, which went to workstation 3. And the question was about what would the source MAC address be. So I remembered back in the module text about all of those exceptions about point-to-point links and how not as much data was needed and addressing wasn't needed because it could only go to one place, and I was having trouble getting my head around that versus with all of the routers in place, is each network segment when the source MAC would change from the port that it went across? I thought I had a good handle on it until I looked at that question and realized maybe I don't.
The thing you've got to understand is that the trick with those questions is that ARP doesn't happen across network boundaries, okay? So if you've got, let's say we've got switch 1 connected to router 1, and then router 1 is connected to router 2, then ARP doesn't travel across router 2. So if you send a host, so let's keep this fairly simple, I hope. We've got workstation 1 connected to switch 1 connected to router 1, which is connected to router 2, which is connected to switch 2, which is connected to workstation 2. Okay, everybody with me? So 1-1-1 and 2-2-2 connected together, and I don't care how they're connected together.
Yep.
So if you send a packet from workstation 1 and you are sending it to workstation 2, it will have the source MAC address of router 2 because it has to be tagged with a source MAC address when it turns up on the router to be sent out onto the local Ethernet. It has to be tagged with the source address of the interface it is being sent out if the packet is being routed.
Okay, so that means that I probably got the question right, because I thought that was the predominant thought, was about network segments being boundaries even for this, and I think they were trying to trip me up, and they almost did with the part about one of the router connections being a point-to-point link because of all that extra data that focused on point-to-point links.
They put red herrings and irrelevant information and stuff in there to try and throw you. And in that particular instance, it's not relevant to what you're doing generally speaking. So the rule of thumb is if you split an Ethernet segment using a router rather than switching rather than splitting it with a switch or a hub or whatever else, that's where the ARP stops, because you've got to remember that a router splits a network into separate broadcast domains, and for ARP to work, it needs a link-level broadcast. So it needs your layer 2 broadcast, and that's why ARP doesn't travel across between routers.
All right, cheers for that. That means I had a better understanding than I thought, and I won't let them... I won't be so easily confused the next time with their trick questions.
Absolutely. Look, some of those are doozies, and they do throw things in, and you think, oh, point-to-point link, okay, what did they say about point-to-point link? And it's like, no, that's not the point at all. No pun intended. Alrighty, any other questions? Queries? Whatever. Alrighty, and that's all we have from Cavi Counseling, because we care. Shall we go into the physical layer, and let's rip through this stuff and see what we come up with. Guys, at this point, we're looking at finishing sometime in mid-December. You may have longer to actually finish stuff off if you get behind. But we're going to try and finish everything off by mid-December. Does that sit okay with everybody, or have you all dashed off to get a drink to steady your nerves?
No, that sounds good. I'm a little behind on exams, so I need to catch up on those a bit. But no, it sounds good. Alrighty.
Did you mention Did you mention us doing another practical exercise last week or something? Or did that get scrapped?
It hasn't been scrapped. I need to try and get the OpenVPN box working. And that should be interesting, because you guys should be able to open VPN into the wireless access points and stuff like that.
Now, if we can get that working, I'd love to do it. That'd be cool.
Yeah, we've just got to do a bit of messing around and bridge it across, and you then have to convince the... convince either your DHCP server not to hand out a default gateway, or, as I keep telling people, do your OpenVPNing in a virtual machine so that you don't knock out your primary internet access. What I can say, however, is if you launch OpenVPN and it knocks out your primary internet access, disconnect the VPN and it will come back. But I'm just waiting for somebody to ring up in a panic and go, every time I open this OpenVPN, it knocks my internet access out. But yeah, don't let it take the default gateway, or you may have temporary connectivity problems from your workstation. Alrighty, so we'll try and get that going fairly soon. I've basically got to redo the box that's got all the OpenVPN in. It's got... three network cards and a few other things in it, so it'll be an interesting experience. Alrighty, let's talk about the physical layer, which is Module 8 stuff. Now, the physical layer is responsible for encoding physical binary into physical voltages and things that travel over the medium. And you're either looking at copper, fiber, or wireless as your various medium types. For the physical layer, you need physical media and associated connectors. Look, it sounds pretty obvious, but it is kind of important. A representation of bits in the media. Encoding of data and control information. Transmitter and receiver circuitry on the network devices. And that's basically what you need for that. Any questions so far? Good. Okay. Now, the important thing here is the media does not carry the frame. It carries the bits that make up the frame. So remember that framing is a function of layer 2. So it's only the bits that travel at the physical layer, bits and voltages. The physical layers are set by engineers such as the ISO, International Standards Organization, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, try saying that 5 times after 6 strawberry daiquiris, the American National Standards Institute, and the International Telecommunications Union. Oh, and the Electronic Industry Association / Telecommunications Industry. I just think they like having lots of weird acronyms. It makes them feel important. Yes, Ian just said that acronyms were invented by computer science people to try and make their discipline look like a real science, like a trade. Okay, there are 4 types of things defined. Now, I love that sentence. I obviously must have, you know, not been having enough Hungry Jacks when I wrote that particular bit of the notes. The physical and electrical properties of the media. Obviously, optical fiber doesn't have electrical properties, or at least it does, but they're not really important to its data carrying capacity. In other words, it doesn't conduct very well at all. The mechanical dimensions, as in the dimensions, the pinouts, the materials, the dimensions, and the pinouts. So, when we were working with coaxial cable, how tight a corner could you bend the various coaxial cable around? And, for example, with the 10^5 coax, you couldn't bend it as much as you could bend the 10^2 coax. And it's probably not as flexible as things like unshielded twisted pair. Has anybody ever seen unshielded twisted pair when people have decided to run it either on the floor, over under a doorway, or under a mat, or somewhere where people are going to stomp and stamp on it, with a subnote to the fact that anybody who passes this course should never be doing this?
I haven't seen it, but I can imagine. Does it sort of flatten out and become unusable?
It's not pretty. The insulation tends to split, the outer insulation tends to split, and then the pairs inside sort of spread out a bit, and you stamp on it until the wire work hardens, and then one of the pairs snaps, and then your network link stops working. Okay, so we talked about the physical and electrical properties of the media. The mechanical stuff, which we already talked about, and the connectors, and how big they are, and how hard they are to stick in, and all that sort of stuff. The bit representation of the signals, so what sort of encoding of the signals we're using, whether we're using non-return to zero, whether we're using Manchester, all that sort of thing. And the definition of control and information signals. Bits are encoded into a signaling standard before they go onto the wire. This allows the hardware to detect the start and end of things, and it allows it to do better error correction and detection. We don't just say 5 volts is 1 and 0 volts is 0. Why don't we say 5 volts is 1 and 0 volts is 0?
One item from the notes was that if you do that and you have a lot of ones, it's harder for the system to tell exactly how many there are if there's a bunch in a row.
Exactly. So if you set 0 volts to be zeros, if the cable's doing nothing and there's 0 volts on it, how many zeros are you transmitting? Okay. So your receiver and transmitter either need their clocks synchronized, or they need transitions to show where clock transitions occur. So, for example, with Manchester encoding, it actually looks at when the signal changes and you'll be able to... you'll actually be able to see by the transitions as to when the ones and zeros come through. Sorry, I just got distracted. Grace was emptying her Haytel at me. My dream iPod doesn't have a speaker on it, but I don't think that'll ever happen. Amplitude, phase, and frequency can be changed in a signal, and that's how we can get information across the wire. So amplitude is the strength of the signal. Frequency is obviously the number of cycles per second, and phase is which way around the waves are going and stuff, in very simple terms. The transitions can be used to ensure synchronization, so if you're expecting a state change from a 0 to a 1 or a 1 to 0 in a particular window, you can actually see that that's actually going to happen, and that can be used for your timing and to detect bit level error. Does anybody care how this signaling stuff works? Because I can get Ian on to explain it to you if anybody wants to know, although he'll probably have to duck out in a minute.
I wouldn't mind a brief explanation.
I'll just see if he's around. Is Ian still here? No? Okay. Did you briefly want to talk to them about things like Manchester encoding in 2 minutes or less, or...? Are you... You got, it's 9:47, you don't have to, if you can't, then that's okay. There's a set on this machine here. I think, do you need a sound card or are you? They should be colour coded. I'll have to buy more of those sets of headphones for you. We've got some headphones that are really sighted unfriendly. They've got little tiny black symbols on a black background, and it's very difficult for even sighted people to tell which is the microphone and which one is the headphones. Blah, guff, wibble. You can hear us, can you? I'll just go off AutoVox, and you can see whether they can hear you. We're talking about types of signal encoding like Manchester and stuff briefly, and roughly how that stuff works. I can't actually hear you. Yeah, you're right. I'm just about to go off.
Okay. So, signaling. Kerry's covered the amplitude part, which is just the level. Frequency is just the number of cycles you have per second. So one of the simplest forms of frequency modulation, or using frequency, is frequency modulation, where for a 1 you would send, for example, 44 kilohertz, and for a 0 you would send 48 kilohertz. So you can tell the difference between the zeros and ones simply because of the frequency. A phase... Sorry?
Just before you do that, can you knock a smidge off your microphone? Are you guys... Are you...
Yeah, it's distorted.
Yeah, I'd be blaming Skype.
Okay, is that better?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, phase. Phase is a little more complex. It's also a little more complex to pick up. But if you consider a sine wave, which starts at 0 volts, slowly builds itself up to a certain voltage, we'll call it 1 volt for our case, reaches that peak and then slowly decays down to 0 volts again, then slowly sinks down to -1 volt and then rises back to 0 again. So it just sort of swings, much like a swing. Okay, now imagine 2 swings. You start the first one off and it moves through half of its cycle. So in our case, it would get to, say, 1 volt. That is when the next signal will start. So it starts at 0 when the first signal has reached its peak. It would be 90 degrees out of phase in that case. Another way of thinking of it would be the classic old song, Row, Row, Row Your Boat, when people come in at different times. That is phase. So the signal measures zeros and ones by this phase shift. All right, so the amount they're out of time with each other. Now, very briefly, Manchester encoding is a method of encoding the signals so that you can recover the timing information. If you think perhaps of a very slow signal, we're going to send 1 bit per second. So each machine tries to send 1 bit per second. It expects to receive a bit every second. If the clocks aren't exactly the same, they will eventually drift out and be expecting ones and zeros at different times. So if our first clock is out by 50%, it'll start sending bits out at 1.5 seconds, whereas the receiver is expecting them every second. After 3 bits, it's picking up exactly the wrong signal. So what we do in Manchester encoding is we don't just use, say, the level to work out when each bit starts and ends. We put a transition in the middle of every single bit. So I can't remember which way around it is. You might want to look this up on Wikipedia, Kerry, and just tell them. It's in straight text, so it's fairly easy to get. So what happens if we have a 1 is signaled by a change from a high to a low in the middle of a bit. So where we see the transition from high, 1 volt, to -1 volt, that marks a 1. Where we have a transition in the middle of a bit from -1 volt to 1 volt, that is a 0. So it works purely on the transitions in the middle of a bit, not the level of a bit. So at the beginning it will have to switch state to either become the high or low it needs to transition from, but it works purely on this transition in the middle of a bit, which means you contain the timing information of the signal within the signal itself. And that way the clocks don't have to be synchronized. The disadvantage of Manchester encoding is that because you have a transition in every single bit, it doubles the required bandwidth. I won't go into that too much, but basically it does. How's that? Manchester encoding in 30 seconds.
So by the middle of the bit, Ian, are you saying that the time that it takes for the full transition from +1 to -1, is that what you mean? I'm not following the terminology. The middle of a bit, if a bit is either yes or no.
Okay, yeah. When you send a bit just with raw data, the signal will be floating along at its idle, say 0 volts. You transition, meaning move up to 1 volt or 5 volts, whatever marks your one, and you hold it there for the bit period, the time a bit is in existence. So if we're sending it 1 bit per second, you would transition from the idle to 5 volts, and you would hold it at 5 volts for 1 second. Then you would look at the next bit, which if it was a 0, it would then transition down to -5 volts, and hold minus 5 volts for 1 second. When you transition in the middle of a bit, it doesn't matter where you start, if you're going from a plus 5 to a minus 5, that marks a 1. If the next bit is a 1 as well, in the raw encoding scheme, we wouldn't have any change of voltage. At the beginning of the bit period, it'll change back to plus 5. Halfway through the bit period, it will do that information transition, which was from plus 5 to minus 5, which marked a 1, and hold that until the beginning of the next bit. So it's a voltage change in the middle of the bit period. Now, the bit period is the inverse of the bits per second that you're sending. So 10 hertz, you're sending 10 bits per second. That is 1/10 of a second each bit period.
No, got it. That did it for me. They just did slightly different terminology. The bit period itself is what you meant by the middle. I got it. Thanks.
No problem.
Any questions before Ian runs off to his meeting?
No, I appreciate that. Glad you had a minute to stop in and see us this semester.
I try. Just don't get that many chances. So, okay, have fun. Speak to you all again soon.
Have a good morning.
Alrighty. Okay, yeah, I used to have trouble getting that explanation right, and he's done it in front of enough Curtin students that I don't have to mess around getting it right. So, there we go. And you all got to see him this semester.
If I were you, I would have asked him to say that piece too. That's a lot of information to compact.
Oh, just as a... No, I'll tell you guys off recording. I'm just going to go back onto auto key. Hang on. Alright, there we go. Yeah, so that's so. Basically, the point of Manchester encoding is that there has to be a transition halfway through the bit time, and you're looking for the transitions to figure out where your timing signal is, and it's actually which way the transition changes as to what bit you're seeing, which is the guts of Manchester encoding. So there you go.
And he said the cost of that is it takes lots of bandwidth because you're sending timing information and data in the same signal?
That is exactly right. You are sending... you are actually sending the transitions and you are sending the... you are actually sending the data and the transitions, so you need to waste a transition to send the timing as well as having the data, which is why it requires more bandwidth.
In the practical application of... Obviously, I haven't had the chance to read the chapter yet, so feel free to tell me to do that, but where is Manchester used the most?
It used to be used on 10^2 coax. You tend to use a Manchester encoding. They also use Manchester encoding. They used to use it on really old hard drive platters. MFM encoding is a version of Manchester. Because if you think about it, if you look at magnetic media, it's actually the changes in polarity that actually get tripped up by the read heads, not the fact that you've got lots of magnetic stuff. It's the fact that the flux on the magnetic platter is changing is how you actually read the data off. Now, obviously, they've got better circuitry and stuff than, say, frequency modulation and MFM, but they did actually used to use Manchester on the old Winchester drives to store the data on the platters magnetically.
Okay, that makes sense.
Oh, what was that cool bell noise in the background I just heard? Or was it somebody tapping on something?
That was my ship's clock coming through the headset. I didn't think that it would.
That's kind of cool. We'll have to find out about that after lecture. That's quite intriguing. Okay. Anyone got any other questions before I go on to preamble and end of frame detection?
I thought I was the only one that had that app.
We're the only two people that know what the signals mean, probably, but yeah, we can talk about it later. Sorry.
No, that's all right. I actually would have to Wikipedia out what the signals mean, but I am familiar that there are various bell-ringy things that do things at different times for different reasons. I just haven't been bored enough yet to look it up, but that might change soon. All right. Now, The other thing to keep in mind is, if you really want to know about this stuff, and not everybody does, this physical layer stuff and how the stuff is actually shoveled over the medium, the book you want is Ethernet, The Definitive Guide by O'Reilly. And if you guys are over in the States, Bookshare, and if you're over here in Australia, Bookswear has it, because you don't get access to the good stuff, and you can't get that over here. So if you're over there and you want Ethernet, The Definitive Guide, toddle off to Bookshare, and I'm pretty sure they have it. Okie dokie. Now, you've got your Ethernet preamble, which is... It used to be used for synchronizing the transmitter and receiver on 10BASE-T Ethernet. Basically, it is an alternating sequence of zeros and ones, 62 of them, followed by two ones, so it's a 64-bit sequence, and it is the preamble to every frame, and it is to allow the transceivers on the media to synchronize before you actually send the data through. I think they ditched it on 10 gigabit Ethernet. I think it still exists on gigabit Ethernet, I'd have to check that, but it was there to actually get the transmitters and receivers ready to receive the next frame. I think there is also information in these notes that talk about the fact that there is what we call an interframe spacing, which is a number of slot times where you actually wait so that the transmitters and receivers can stabilize and sort their stuff out. It's a little breather. It's a bit like the 5 seconds of bliss you've got between the incoming blindy calls once you've released the new version of something. You know, the system will actually put in, you know, 5 seconds between the calls so that you've got a chance to you know, gulp down a mouth of coffee before the next call. Now, this recoding stuff, it can be used on high-speed media. It can reduce bit-level error. It can be used for limiting the energy of energy transmitted into the media. Now, when we say that, we're referring to things like optical fiber, where if you leave a laser on too long, you're going to burn it out. So what you actually do is, I'm not exactly sure how the encoding works exactly, but the non-return to zero coding allows the intensity and stuff of the laser to be constantly changing, so that you're not turning on and off a laser diode all the time, because that burns them out. Okay, any questions on any of that so far? Okay, if we're looking at the data carrying capacity of a, if we're looking at the data carrying capacity of a medium, we have three terms that we need to look at: end width, throughput, and good put. Okay, so bandwidth is the amount of stuff a media can theoretically carry at any given time. We have analog bandwidth and we have digital bandwidth. Analog bandwidth is measured in hertz, megahertz, gigahertz. Digital bandwidth is measured in bits per second, and it's always measured in bits per second. Throughput is the amount of is the amount of data sent over a given time, and it's affected by the media usage and the number of network devices. And good put is the amount of user data that actually makes it over the network in a given time period, given the changes and fluctuations in network usage and stuff. So good put is what you're really getting from a user perspective. We've got to note things like various standards and maximum lengths. So we all know that you can't run a single run of 10 base T or 100 base T or 1000 base T more than 100 meters unless you buy nasty non-standards exceeding Ethernet-y things to shovel it even further. And if it breaks, you keep both pieces. we all know that single-mode fiber goes more than multi-mode fiber. Multi-mode fiber, which uses a light signal to go down the fiber, and single-mode fiber, which uses a laser. So single-mode uses coherent light, and it goes straight down the fiber. It is a straight beam, and it will travel further. So you're looking at basically almost double the distance for single-mode fiber as opposed to multi-mode fiber, but the transmitters and receivers are more expensive, and you do have to run fiber in straighter runs and stuff because the lasers don't tend to bend around corners anywhere near as well as the light does. Copper cables, various connectors, RJ11, RJ12, RJ45, all that sort of thing, and they can be interfered by via noise. So you don't run copper cables over fluorescent light ballasts. You don't run copper cables near electric motors. And you try not to run copper cables and things past things that generate a whole lot of noise. So has anybody had an experience where you've got your headphone cables and stuff all draped all over the place, and you happen to have them running across your laptop charger, and you get a nice hum in your signal? Has anybody seen that?
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen that.
We actually had somebody who suggested, and this was a very interesting one, if you think you've got hum in your equipment that is generated by a ground loop, apparently one of the troubleshooting tricks that they used to do was if you lick your finger and touch the case, you'll actually change the way everything's grounded, and you can actually tell whether it's a grounding loop or something else. Okay, twisting the pairs builds up a magnetic shieldy thing that protects cables from interference. And the reason they twist the pairs is to limit the amount of external interference that gets into the cables. The higher the category of cables, the more twists per meter. And they have to do that because once you start getting up into the 100 megabits, gigabit range, you need to be protecting yourself from that interference because it becomes easier and easier to interfere with the signals that are travelling at those high speeds. The point that they're making in the notes here is that it is expensive to recable an entire network, especially if you've got to rerun cable through all the ducting and stuff. Category 6 actually has a physical separator that separates the pairs from each other to improve the, diminish the amount of crosstalk and stuff. What will actually happen is, with gigabit, you actually send and receive stuff at the same time. There are apparently 9 different signals on the wires at once, and it actually uses all 4 pairs at both directions simultaneously. So if you actually look at it with a multimeter or whatever, you'll constantly see the pairs in a state of collision. Okay. The notes want me to talk about crossover cables, rollover cables, and straight-through cables. Did any of you listen to the cable-making demos yet?
I have not.
Not yet.
Okay. I do have to do a hard link into that section so that you guys can all find it in exploration, but they are actually under Discovery Lab demos, and one of the labs that you guys get to do at some point does involve writing up a couple of paragraphs on how to make a cable. And no, the correct answer is not get in touch with JJ and get blind bargains to sort you in a box of 30 off Amazon.com. I will fail anybody who puts that answer into their test, even if it is going to be quicker and easier. Okay, a straight-through cable, we talked, is used for connecting different devices together, so it's used for connecting a PC to a hub, a PC to a switch, switch to a router. That's where you've got pairs 1 and 2, 3 and 6, 1 and 2, 3 and 6, 4 and 5, 7 and 8. And if you're listening to Geraldine's Little Green White Green song, then I'm sorry, I can't help you. But that will actually teach you the colours. And if you listen to the cable demo from 2007, Geraldine will sing you the cable song. And you may enjoy that. Then again, you might not. The straight through cable, the crossover cable is for connecting like devices, so a PC to a PC, a switch to a switch, a hub to a hub. There is also a wrinkle where connecting a PC to a router or something, you used to have to use one. I'd have to actually check the notes up on that, but there was an odd one where you actually did have to use a straight through cable. A crossover cable to do the connect. If you are actually vision impaired, may I strongly recommend that you find some way of marking your cables, because you will not be able to tell by looking at the ends of them what the whether the cables are crossover or not. A rollover cable is usually used for console connections to Cisco routers. It has an RJ45 on one end, and sometimes it has an RJ45 on the other end that gets converted to a serial cable. The reason they're called rollover cables is pins 1 to 8 are connected to pins 8 to 1 on the other end. Do I need to talk to anybody about coaxial cable? Does everybody know what coaxial cable is, or do I need to explain it?
I'm surrounded by it right now with radio equipment.
Alright, anybody else confused about coaxial cable, or have you all seen it with your cable television and that sort of stuff? Something that we don't have a lot of over here in Australia.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, I've seen it. If you could describe how it differs from Ethernet. I'm familiar a little bit with the notes, but I haven't had much interaction with it.
Okay. Well, basically, in a nutshell, it is one big fat round cable. Depending on how big and fat and round it is, depends on the type of coax. It has a central single core. It then has some insulation, and it then has some braiding, and then it has some more insulation, and the signal goes down through the middle and comes back through the edge. But the braiding is also used as a shield, and it doesn't bend as well as Ethernet cable, and generally speaking, it's not used in modern data networking unless you're not using optical fiber for some reason and you need to run network signals in magnetically noisy environments, because it has better signal resistance to noise than, say, twisted pair. But you probably are unlikely to see it unless you're playing with cable television or similar.
Okay, thanks.
Now, shielded twisted pair is like regular twisted pair, except that the four pairs are actually wrapped in a foil jacket for shielding, and the problem is that it has to be correctly grounded, otherwise the shielding acts like an antenna and picks up all of the signals around it. Which is interesting. Some of those interference that you can cause can be actually quite interesting. And we'll talk about that off lecture. There are dangers when you're running cable for lightning and voltage. And it's basically, depending on how you wire this stuff up, you've got to wire it up sensibly, and there are all sorts of rules and regulations so that you don't fry your equipment or your people. People don't tend to work for you very long after you fried them. Insulation may cause problems if burnt or heated. PVC insulation tends to emit noxious gas that kills people when you heat it. This is obviously unpleasant for the people concerned and can sometimes be quite fatal. Which is why when you are running cables in buildings and ceiling spaces and stuff, you need to run, I think they call it plenum grade cable or something, and it uses an insulation that is not made of PVC and is more fire resistant and fire retardant and doesn't kill people when you heat it up. Okay, fiber uses light and does not conduct electricity very well because obviously it's glass or plastic. Higher bandwidth, and it can go over long distance depending on the standards that you're running it over. Different skills for handling fiber, and it's more expensive but allows higher bandwidth. So if you've got the money and the resources, you put fiber in initially and then you are better off. You need two fibers to do full duplex, one fiber for sending, one fiber for receiving. Don't look into an active fiber because it can damage your eyes. We always have to say that. Why you would be doing that is beyond me. Has anybody seen those fiber Christmas trees where you put batteries in it and it all lights up and apparently looks pretty pretty and it all shines out of those little stringy things, those fibers and stuff, and they're all different colours? Has anybody seen those?
I've heard of them.
That sounds pretty wild.
Well, it's pretty cool, and it means you don't have to have your tree dropping bits of stuff everywhere, and people tend to like that. Alrighty, any questions before we continue on?
Just one question about the, back to the Ethernet cable wiring. When it says, pair 4 and 5, is that on both ends of the connector, or is that pair, or, pin 4 on one end to pin 5 on the other end? I'm not quite understanding how that fits in.
If it says 4 and 5, that's 4 and 5 on one end because it's considered a pair. Do you need Sujin to help you with something, Grace? Because I've still got about another 20-30 minutes of lecture. So if you want to retask him to do something. Grace?
What's that?
Do you want Sujin to help you with something? Because I'm going
to
be another... Not even the discovery stuff?
I'm not going to have him do that. I've already trained Tracy.
Okay.
She's coming in. She's doing today.
Okay. Wireless media travels through air and it can be interfered with. They're saying here that security is important on wireless networks. I'm not even going to talk about that. If you guys don't know that by now, I'll be very unhappy. Wireless LANs have stations and they have access points. Can anybody tell me what is the difference between a station and an access point?
Well, stations connect to access points, and stations can't connect to other stations and get internet access, is that right?
Kind of. Stations can connect to other stations. It's called an ad hoc network. Can anybody be more specific?
The access point is what lets you go off network.
Not quite. Okay, so I might have to go through this.
And the access point is actually the router that interfaces with...
You're a long way away, Corey. Stations are hosts and access points are... Okay. A station is a device that is... As Corey said, it's like a host. So, generally speaking, your PC will have a wireless card in it that acts in station mode. Now, station mode means that it has two modes of communications. It can either talk to an access point, or it can talk ad hoc to other stations. The job of an access point is to mediate access to the wireless network. So an access point is responsible for beaconing. It is responsible for the carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance protocol. It is required for mediating which stations can transmit when, and it is also required for sending the signals back out to the other stations. So if you're talking from one wireless network device or one station to another through an access point, all traffic has to travel through that access point. Has anybody ever played with JoyQ Spot or Walking Hotspot or similar applications on Nokia phones? Has anybody seen those?
Yeah,
I've used JoyQ Spot.
Okay, so what that basically does is it turns your phone into an ad hoc wireless station, because you cannot put your phone into station mode because the radios on it don't support it. And it basically allows you to then share your phone's internet connection with a number of mobile devices. However, I think with the older BrailleSense chipset, you cannot connect to ad hoc wireless networks. So does anybody have a better idea now about the difference between stations and access points?
I'm embarrassed to say it, but only slightly. Maybe if you did another dessert analogy or something, it would work better for me.
Okay. So, I don't know, if you're a station, it's like self-serve apple pie, where you go and you get the pieces of the apple pie, and then with an access point, it's like where you have this server, and you go and talk to the server and go, can I please have a piece of apple pie? And it says, yeah, okay, here's your piece of apple pie, and the bowl of apple pie turns up. And then when you're finished, you take the bowl back to the waiter person, and they put it away, and they're responsible for mediating how much apple pie you eat. Does that help? Maybe? No?
You actually took the challenge.
Absolutely.
Yes, I've got it. We do not like access points because they mediate how much we can eat.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Yeah, we get rid of the access point. So when you actually set up wireless networks, has everybody been through that silly wireless access network wizardy thing under Windows where you get to see whether it's a my network uses access points or my access uses ad hoc, and you tell it whether it's a PC to PC network or whether you're looking for an access point? Has anybody seen that?
Yep.
Okay, so what happens is when you have wireless, let's assume we've got a laptop with a wireless card, what actually happens, we're assuming that card is in station mode, just for simplicity. When you go into, has everybody seen that thing under Windows where it goes, I can't actually make the pop noise this morning, which is very sad. And it says one or more wireless networks is available. Click here to connect to these networks. Everybody seen that one? Okay, so what happens is every 250 milliseconds, unless you've changed it, or you've hidden your SSID, you have a beacon that goes out that says, CAVI, wireless network CAVI, wireless network CAVI, wireless network CAVI, every 250 milliseconds. So when you go scan for wireless networks, your wireless network card listens for beacons from the access points, and then it gives you a list of networks, and you click on the one that you want to connect to. If you would like to confuse 98% of the Mac-using population, hide your wireless network, and they will complain when it doesn't show up automatically, as I discovered by doing that and having about 3 different Mac users tell me that we had no wireless network active because it wasn't showing up in their little thing. Then of course another Mac user walked in and said, well, it's a hidden network, why don't you just type it in there, see where it says hidden network, like how hard can it be, people? And then they were all very sad, but I ended up having to unhide it because it was just causing too much grief explaining to people that yes, the network really was there, and if I told you that's what it was called, could you please key it in? So, your station modes listen for beacons, they then communicate with the access point. They do not generally communicate directly with other wireless stations, and all traffic goes through the access point. This is why you place your access point at the most central point of your wireless network, so that its donut-shaped radiation pattern, donuts, what I wouldn't do for a chocolate and cream custard a donut right now. Its donut-shaped pattern will then be able to get to all of the wireless stations that are around your access point. The other thing they tell you in the book, which nobody ever reads, is put your access points up nice and high so that there is less stuff for the wireless signal to go through, and that way the signal will travel further. When we say up nice and high, a meter or two on a bookshelf is good, but if you have the wireless access point sitting on the floor in the corner, it doesn't work too well. I actually knew somebody who will remain nameless on this lecture that was so rotund that if they stood between our access point and the laptop, you wouldn't actually get a signal through them. This was quite disturbing. Device mobility is kind of cool, and the lack of cables is kind of cool, but security is really, really important. Everybody has a password or security on their wireless network on here, do they? Do you all have a password / security on your wireless network?
Yep.
Absolutely.
Now, you don't have to be as crazy as Kevin and go in and generate a 26-character web password with some bizarre online password generation tool and then copy and paste it between all of your devices. Because that's just going a bit wild, but as long as you've got some sort of password on your network, it's usually pretty good. And to be honest, I'm not going to bother hacking Kevin's network. I'm just going to bust into his flat and reconfigure his router, because that'll just be easier. So, you know, security versus usability, whatever you want to do. Also, as you guys have probably learnt the hard way, has anybody ever tried typing in a really, really big, long password on their iPhone and gotten really upset with it, especially if it's in hexadecimal? I was very happy to move to WPA2, where we could actually use a password for our networks. But obviously, make sure you've got a good one, and make sure that all of your equipment can support the wireless encryption standard that you're using. And that is the end of our prepared notes for this module. Does anybody have any questions? Alrighty, I shall hit stop on the recording.